What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
We have a special episode today of Solving JFK. We're going to be talking to Jim DiEugenio, Paul Blow, Andrew Eiler, and Mark Adamczyk, my co-authors of the new book, The JFK Assassination Chokeholds That Inescapably Proved There Was a Conspiracy. We'll talk about it today on this bonus episode of Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton.
I want to give a special disclaimer for this episode. This is sort of a spoiler alert. If you are just going down the track of following the podcast episodes in order, this is one that is definitely out of order and kind of gives away sort of a lot of the plot in advance without footnotes in the podcast. You'll have to get the book for the footnotes. But I want to point out that, you know, I wrote two chapters for this book, and the ones that I wrote are about topics that I've already studied that I, you know, came across during season one of the podcast, specifically Oswald, whether he could have been in place on the sixth floor at 12:30, and also whether or not Oswald was impersonated. So I say all that to say that while I do agree with the, you know, premise of this book, and I agree with the factual propositions that are supported by footnotes, I'll just add that we haven't covered a lot of this stuff yet. So when I get to these things and I give it the Solving JFK treatment, you know, we'll break it all down. We'll have all the citations, and we'll also bring in some viewpoints on the other side so that we can understand, you know, what the arguments are. But nevertheless, it was exciting to be part of this project, and there's your disclaimer, spoiler alert. Back to the episode. Just to tell the backstory a little bit of kind of how this book came to be, the four of us, so all of us except for Andrew, myself, Jim, Paul, and Mark, we were in Dallas last year at the 2022 Dallas conference, and we just started kind of talking about the case, and then, you know, distinguished the idea that some bodies of evidence really are much stronger than other bodies of evidence, almost like they're inescapable, like a chokehold, right? So we, you know, of course, people who are enthusiasts of the JFK assassination love to talk about all the little details and all the little arguments, you know, the inside baseball of it all. So that's what we started doing. And sort of one thing led to another. And we had this project, and we didn't even know if it was going to be a book or what it was going to be. I mean, it was probably going to be a book the whole time, really, right? But we were like hoping it was going to be some futuristic hologram, something. I don't know what we thought. You know, we put this book out last Tuesday. And I think it's my summary of it, and then I'll toss to you guys, is, you know, I think it's a pretty good summary of the 10 strongest bodies of evidence, the 10 strongest arguments as to why, you know, there had to have been a conspiracy in the assassination of JFK.
Well, I think that's a very good introduction. You're absolutely right. There's an awful lot of persuasive arguments. You know, if you take, for instance, the backyard photos, that appeared in Life magazine that seemed fake with crop lines and everything. I think you could say that's persuasive, but the type of subject that we wanted to go after were the ones that were indisputable, as you said. So the example that we gave last year was actually, because the word chokehold, I had first heard it used by Malcolm Blunt. And Malcolm was talking about how Oswald's file was managed by the CIA when he was in Russia. And because of the way it was managed, including a late opening of a standard 201 file, the fact that his file did not go to the Soviet Russia division, but went to the Office of Security Division, for many reasons, it was quite obvious that this was the file of a fake defector. So Malcolm used the word chokehold on that. He says there's no explanation for it. And I think that if you take the 10 subjects we look at, we had a lot of debate. We remember how we all voted, and we had a few more that we eliminated because they didn't reach the standard that we felt we reached with these ones.
Jim, I know you've written several books about the JFK assassination. You're certainly the most renowned of our group of co-authors when it comes to writing books, no doubt about that. Just quick question, like, how was this, writing this book, this anthology, your contributions to it, was that a totally different ballgame from the books you've written in the past and your process?
Well, yeah, because the other books that I had either written or co-edited, when I say co-edited, that's the book, The Assassinations, which I co-edited with Lisa Peace. But I wrote a substantial amount, probably a majority of the articles in that anthology, certainly if you go by page count. All right. So this one, I was, you know, one among several people, you know, and I was allowed to go ahead and concentrate on the two areas, which I think are very significant, you know, and I think are actually conclusive. That is the mystery of Kennedy's brain. All right, number one, and the charade of Commission Exhibit 399, commonly called the magic bullet. And in the first case, that's relatively new, all right, the whole thing, the controversy about Kennedy's brain. In the second case, I tried to avoid the cliched, trite thing about, the bullet comes in this way, it goes out this way. I tried to concentrate on the chain of custody because those things are pretty new. And by the way, when I say new, what I'm talking about is we know about these things through the years and the declassifications of the review board. That's what I try and concentrate on now because I believe that the mainstream media did everything they could to ignore the discoveries of the review board. And I believe they did that for the simple fact that they are so devastating to the case. And by the way, let me add one more thing. If you look closely at what's happening, number one, you had the Landis bullet in the New York Times and the Vanity Fair, something that's really remarkable. All right. Number two, you now have what the doctor saw on Paramount Plus, which Matt is one of the commentators on, along with Doug Horn, seven doctors, and Robert Tannenbaum. They've been trying to sell that film for a long, long time, and they finally managed to break through this year. All right. And then you have the this new version of the magic bullet done in a lab, in a scientific lab, which, to put it mildly, contradicts the ABC version done by Dale Myers. So I believe between those three things and their exposure, all right, and I'm not even going to mention the Rob Reiner thing because that just started, I mean, this is really a kind of remarkable confluence of events. And so along with the book, The Chokeholds, I think it's all, as they say, consistent with each other. All right. And so it only took 60 years, right? One other thing I'd like to say. The other two lawyers we have on, and this, of course, in addition to Matt, Andrew and Mark, I believe have done some really remarkable work on the whole scandal. DARB was supposed to be final in 2017. Everything was supposed to be declassified. Here we are in 2023, going into 2024, and it's still not completely out. And these two guys, I believe, I'm very proud to publish them at kennysandking.com, have done what I think is the best work on the violations of the ARB Act and the resistance to getting out those last 4,000 documents. And they're both part of this team.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good transition to kick it to Andrew and Mark to talk about, one of the biggest parts of the book that I think JFK Assassination Chokeholds does a good job of uniquely is capturing the current status of the JFK Records Act and exactly where we are, or the Biden transparency plans and all that kind of fun stuff, which I know Andrew and Mark are more experts on. So Andrew, you want to give us just a sort of quick update on your thoughts on that obstruction of justice chapter and update, I guess, just you can just give us your thoughts on that obstruction of justice chapter. And then also, yeah, feel free to chime in on, where we are in terms of the JFK Records Act. And then we'll go to Mark after that.
Yeah. I had to go back to law school times to really take a look at the subject of standards of proof, which is part of the opening of the book. And it was startling to me in reviewing the Warren Commission report and the House Select Committee on Assassinations final report that those bodies gave lip service to the available standards of proof to look at the evidence about conspiracy or whether Oswald was guilty or not. And to learn that neither of these bodies implemented or held their evidence to any standard of proof really goes to the fact that their findings and conclusions were arrived at entirely arbitrarily. And then I spent a lot of time with the JFK Assassination Records Act of 1992 and looking at that and the way mainly President Trump initially and the Gannon memo that happened in 2017 that started the withholding after that 2017 deadline, the first thing that Trump's attorneys went after was the standard of proof that was set out in Section 6. They gutted the JFK Assassination Records Act by decimating Section 6, which sets out the criteria for postponement of the withheld records. But it also got rid of the clear and convincing standard of proof. And I find it interesting that now none of the bodies that have been tasked with finding the truth about the JFK assassination are now held to any standard of proof. Those 4,000 documents that President Biden is keeping in secret, they're being kept in secret without any standard of proof whatsoever. And like you've said, Matt, this is part of a continuing 60 years of obstruction of justice following the assassination. It's pretty depressing that we're still here.
Yeah, and if you could just unpack that maybe one level deeper without getting too super legalese and in the weeds, how is it possible for a president to just with a pen and by executive order
you know, just do away with a whole section of an act that's already been duly passed? I mean, how does that pass legal muster?
Yeah, it really doesn't. There, the act says that all provisions that don't have to deal with the formation or direct operation of the Assassination Records Review Board are to remain in force and operable law until the archivist says that all of the records are released. Well, there's still 4,000 records that are not released. And Section 6 of the Act, which again sets out the criteria for postponement and the standard of proof for postponing the records, has nothing to do with the operation or formation of the ARRB. And in 2017, Office of Counsel lawyer Curtis Gannon, in a memo to President Trump, essentially said Section 6 is no longer operable. Again, even though Section 12B of the Act says Section 6 continues to be operable until all records are released. There's no basis in law for getting rid of Section 6. And the president is absolutely subject to the Section 6 criteria. It's an unlawful action.
Learning a new language is one of those skills that truly stays with you. And it's incredibly rewarding once you start hearing yourself understand and speak it naturally. Rosetta Stone makes it simple to get started and easy to keep going when it comes to learning a new language. You've probably heard of Rosetta Stone. They've been the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you truly pick up your new language naturally. There's no memorizing random vocabulary lists or feeling lost. For me, I've always wanted to travel to Spain, so I know that when I make that trip, I'm going to be speaking the best Espanol that I can possibly speak, and I'm going to do it with the help of Rosetta Stone. Another great thing about Rosetta Stone is that they help you speak with the appropriate accent so you don't sound like a weirdo in some other country. With 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more, Rosetta Stone is the go-to tool for real language growth. You'll learn faster and retain longer. Rosetta Stone immerses you in your new language naturally, helping you think and communicate with confidence. No English translations, so you truly learn to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. And you can learn from anywhere. Rosetta Stone fits your lifestyle with flexible on-the-go learning. You can access lessons from your desktop or the mobile app, whether you just have 5 minutes or for an hour. So don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Solving JFK listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. That's rosettastone.com/today to start learning right away. Chronological age is your birthday. Biological age is how old your body really is, and it's the strongest predictor of disease risk and mortality. True Diagnostic gives you your biological age and health markers, plus a simple personalized 90-day plan after analyzing over a million data points. Their True Age test measures longevity and aging and includes Symphony Age, tracking the health of 11 organ systems, like your heart, brain, lungs, immune system, and more. The test also gives you the top 3 things that you can do right now to slow down or reverse the aging process for you specifically. You can order online, and the kit ships right to your door. It's just a quick, simple finger prick at home, and then you drop it in the prepaid return package. Your only job is to follow the 3 recommendations for 90 days, and then you can retest to check your progress. True Diagnostic offers a one-time kit, or you can get a subscription of 4 tests every 90 days. So check out True Diagnostic. They use advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over a million biomarkers, and they help you identify the 3 most important things you can do over the next 3 months to make your health better. They're trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. Right now, Solving JFK listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using code JFK20 at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code JFK20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the combo kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com.
Mark, what do you think the likelihood is that that there will ever be success in challenging that action?
Well, there's been attempts, but like Andrew said, and I know Jim has said on multiple interviews, that the presidents, both Biden and Trump, have rewritten the law, and they're getting away with it. You asked the question, Matt, how does a president, you know, issue an executive order to do this? And like Andrew said, it's not only is it not proper, but there's a provision right in the opening statements of the act that says any executive order where a president could just certify something on the grounds of national security. I think that the trend started in the early 80s with Reagan, where you just say, national security, here's an executive order. Well, the JFK Act was passed by Congress to put a stop to that. And Congress said only in the rarest of circumstances could any record be withheld at this point in time. And that was in 1992. So that's what, 30 years ago. So fast forward 30 years, they're still doing it after Congress, by unanimous vote, including approval by President Biden, said enough's enough. And, Andrew said they established very clear standards for postponement, that the ARRB would have to review then. And then, but what's fascinating is between 98 and 2017, essentially nothing was done. Maybe 1,000 records were released, but the archivist kind of had a knock on the door of the agencies leading up to the 2017 deadline and say, guys, we got to get this done. And it just wasn't. And then, like Andrew said, Trump ran away from it for 3 years under cover of the Gannon memo. And then Biden has made it worse and essentially has told the agencies that they're now in control of the remaining JFK collection, which is just extremely upsetting. And that's where we're at.
Well, hopefully there will be some litigation at some point that can, look, even Gerald Posner is an advocate of letting all the documents out. So if, hey, let's get those docs out. Paul, you wrote the chapter, The Official Record Impeaches the Warren Commission, right? I believe that was one of yours.
Yes.
So I looking at that again, it really is something how there are so many people who were insiders of all these various investigations who, they said under various different circumstances, they later said, hey, I don't think it was a single shooter, or I don't think Oswald was involved. You want to talk about maybe some of the highlights of that chapter, which is our first substantive one that kicks off the book?
Yeah, I think it was a really good chapter to kick it off for precisely that reason. Sometimes I watch these shows where they bring in so-called pundits. Okay, pundits that come and say, and they give their impressions on who Oswald was, and they'll go through a lot of pretty gratuitous information, not well substantiated, and for some reason they're considered experts by some of the some of the media. So what happened? I think what we did with this chapter is we've turned the tables on the what people like you and some of the authors right here and others who believe there was a conspiracy are often called. We're often called quacks or people that are misguided, except that that chapter presents not only, I think it's over 90 insiders statements where they're on the record saying that they don't believe in the single bullet theory, that the fingerprints of intelligence are all over Oswald. The things they're saying are absolutely devastating. And it comes from a mix of lawyers, police officers, doctors, counsel, legal counsel on the commission, staff members, and the very top people, the very, very top people in some of these six investigations that took place to look into the assassination. We're talking about, you know, if you look at the church committee, you couldn't get higher than Senator Schweiker and Senator Hart. And if you look at the HSCA that followed, you could not get higher than Tannenbaum, Blakey, Cromwell, and Sprague.
Sprague.
And you look at what they said. And by the way, I also want to clear up one thing. It's even what the documents themselves say. It's not just, you know, what the insiders say. If you read what the House Select Committee says, is, and I'll just quote here, it says the evidence they came up with indicates that the investigation of the assassination was deficient. Okay? And they say that the three intelligence agencies, the Secret Service, FBI and CIA did not perform their responsibilities. They didn't take on their responsibilities well to pass on information to the Warren Commission. The HSCA even concludes that there was a probable conspiracy, and they too completely repudiate the Warren Commission. Yet, for some reason, media seems to be of the opinion, for some reason, that the official record is what these pundits they have on say. And it's so totally the contrary. When you read that chapter, what it does is I think it sets up our credibility. It turns the tables on really who should have the quack label. Is it the persons who really have doubts about the single bullet theory or those who still espouse that ridiculous theory? So that's how I would describe that first chapter. There was a highlight for me. It's always been Richard Schweiker. And that one line he says, I'm going to paraphrase. He said, and he said a few real incredible ones. But he said, I believe the Warren Commission was set up to feed pablum to the American people. It has, in fact, collapsed like a house of cards. And I think it started actually with the House of Cards part. But for someone to say that, you know, Richard Schweiker saying that, and there's no doubt to it about it. So who would you rather put your trust into? You know, some of these so-called pundits or the people who actually questioned the witnesses, who had access to classified documents, who had subpoena power, who saw the wounds, who question people looking at them in their eyes. So I think that's a very powerful chapter.
Let's not forget what Schweiker told Bob Tannenbaum when Bob Tannenbaum first went to Washington.
Yeah.
He went into his office because the church committee had given him delivered a report on the Kennedy assassination. That's called the Schweiker-Hart report. The other guy was Gary Hart. All right, and Gayton Fonzie was working for them. And so Tannenbaum went to his office with his chief investigator, Cliff Fenton. They talked for a few minutes, and then Schweiker asked that Cliff Fenton leave the room because he wanted to talk to Tannenbaum in private. And so he gave him all of the notes that Fonzie had accumulated in the space of about 10 or 11 months. And according to Tannenbaum, Schweiker said the CIA assassinated President Kennedy, and he gave him the folder. They went back to Tannenbaum's apartment. They stayed up until dawn reading this stuff. And Fenton told Tannenbaum, Bob, you know we're in over our heads, don't you? Okay. That's what the House Select Committee could have been. Okay. That's what it could have been. All right. And so we tried to show that this idea that somehow all these official investigations were somehow unanimous, okay, is a bunch of balderdash. All right. And as Andrew noted in his contribution, the whole idea of a standard of proof is to protect society from going ahead and convicting an innocent man, all right? I don't think there's any better example of what society becomes with the collective unconscious guilt of doing so in a high profile case like this. As we know, it's 65% now. All right. A very, very small minority believes the Warren Commission, and about 17% of those who don't think the CIA was involved in the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, the numbers are definitely taken back up towards the Warren Report critic side for sure. Let's talk about another chapter, another one of these chokeholds, which was Oswald's intelligence connections. In particular, I think if people aren't, you know, if there's a name you're not familiar with that's really a big deal, Betsy Wolfe is a great place to start.
I'm the guy who first wrote about Betsy Wolfe. Except it wasn't me, it was Malcolm Blunt, who sent me these files. Okay, what that guy sent me, I mean, I could never repay him, you know, for all the stuff he sent me. But what he said when he sent me this stuff, he goes, Jim, Betsy Wolfe was on to Oswald before anybody was on to Oswald. Just go ahead and read this stuff. Betsy Wolfe was the analyst of the Oswald file at the House Select Committee on Assassinations. So what she did is she asked for every charter from every division in the CIA, which I believe it's nine. It was nine at that time. So she read through every single charter. And then after she read it, she mapped out on the wall, okay, then this is what Oswald's file should have done. So then she asked for the file. And guess what? It didn't do anything like that at all. All right. So now when she discovers this paradox between what should have been and what was, she starts bringing in guys from the CIA, some of them still at work, some of them retired. All right. And one by one, they all agree with her. You're right. It shouldn't have gone to the Office of Security. It should have gone to the Soviet Russian division. You're also right. There should have been a 201 file opened on Oswald. There's no doubt about that. So she does this for months on end, trying to figure out what the heck really happened. Then in the fall of 1978, she calls in a guy named Robert Gambino. Robert Gambino, at that time, at that current time, was the chief of the Office of Security, all right? And he looks at this and he says, look, it doesn't matter how many documents come in. It doesn't matter if they're pre-stamped. If the client goes to the first gate, which is the Office of Mail Logistics, and he requests that those documents go to him, that is what will happen. In other words, somebody was rigging Oswald's file from the beginning. Now, here's my question. Who the heck knew who Oswald was at that time? At the time he defected to the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Pete Bagley was a senior officer. He was involved, I believe. Jim, correct me if I'm wrong. But one of his, he would recruit an awful lot of defectors. And he was weighed in on the whole Nozienko case, who was probably, I don't want to call him a fake defector, but Peter Bagley, Malcolm Blunt had a lunch with Peter Bagley, and he asked him a question to the effect of Oswald going to Russia like that as a false defector, or was it witting or not? And Malcolm didn't really know how to answer. And Peter Bagley said that it had to be witting. So in other words, what he revealed, Peter Bagley, and this is a high, high level officer who's in the know of this sort of stuff, revealed that Oswald was part of a ruse. Jim, am I missing anything on that? I'm pretty sure that's...
Yeah, you're missing one thing.
Go ahead.
He showed him Betsy's work.
Oh, I didn't know that, though. Okay.
Yeah, he showed him the strange routing of Oswald's file based upon Betsy Wolfe. Now, you want to hear something very strange, perhaps the strangest thing of all?
Let's hear it.
And this tells you about the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Betsy Wolff's work, at least what Malcolm sent me, is all in handwritten notes. In other words, it was never transcribed in the memorandum form or typewritten, all right? And it was never part of the volumes. In other words, like the explosive Mexico City report, you know, at least that was typed. At least those guys typed that. But hers are in, I'm glad she had good handwriting, okay? Hers were all in handwritten notes. They were never transcribed at the office into a memorandum form, which I believe is utterly amazing.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think they were never transcribed?
Matt, are you trying to set me up? Are you throwing me a slow ball? Okay, so I can hit it out of the park.
I mean, no, that is weird. You know, I mean, look, I like to take the other side of things. You know, like, you know, because I know what people are going to say. Well, they were just busy. They were busy. That's why they didn't type it. You know, but yeah, it's wild once you start digging into that. And this may be a little weird for some. You know, the things we're covering, the things that are covered in chokeholds, these are like the top 10 once you get to the end of the road, right? This is a book, this book that I've been blessed to be able to co-write with these guys. These guys have been in the game for a long time. So we've only covered, you know, some specific topics. We haven't covered, we got a little taste of Oswald being impersonated. We got a little taste of, you know, the front shot and the chain of evidence with CE-399, but this obstruction of justice stuff is new. New to my audience. The conversation about Oswald having intelligence ties is new, as is the conversation, you know, in the first chapter about just all the investigation insiders over the years. I couldn't believe it, you know, for the impersonations chapter, which is one of my contributions. We documented 20 different instances. So it was really something. And there were a lot of them that I didn't include. By the way, shout out to Jerry Simone. He gave me a few more that I wasn't aware of. But these, when I say impersonated, I don't mean, oh, somebody thinks that they saw a guy who looks like they saw a guy and then they saw Oswald on TV and they said, oh, that I saw Oswald before. It's not just that. It's there's something else going on too. Oh, you know, he's in this grocery store and he's with a wife that had dark hair that, you know, was speaking a foreign language and a short, chubby old lady was with them. Yeah. Oh, it's like, okay, well, that's not just Lee. It's a couple other people too. But the point is, these are sightings when we know that Oswald's already accounted for. So I guess that to kind of tee up a question to you guys, what do you think all these Oswald impersonations are about? It is a chokehold that he was impersonated. It's not possible to argue otherwise based on the evidence. My question to you is, what are we to make of that?
You've heard me talk about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. I'm talking about Mood.com, which has created an entire line of functional gummies and flower crafted for your ideal mood, made with 100% federally legal THC. Not only that, but they'll deliver them directly to your doorstep so you can have your own clandestine herbal journey. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. What makes Mood.com's gummies different is how they've paired THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're just not going to find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. But their flower is what really blows me away. They partner with small family-owned American farms who are custom cultivating their bud with unique terpene profiles. So you can choose a strain to help you feel more social, chilled out, or even more focused and productive. Best of all, not only does Mood.com stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you can get 20% off your first order with code JFK. So head to Mood.com and browse their amazing selection of functional gummies and flower and find the perfect one for whatever you're dealing with. Remember, use promo code JFK at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you don't mind, I'll weigh in, but I'll give a lot of time for the others. The key thing is he always looked unhinged, and he was often with Latino escorts. Often, I'm thinking of the shooting range, for instance. In the case of Mexico City, what was the message people were getting, you know, that they could interpret from the sightings? Is A, that we have an unhinged guy, but that also that he was under the influence of Castro or Castro agents. Now, I can't say that's the case for every one of the sightings, but if you take at the shooting range, one of the Latinos accompanying him is this tall guy with a Castro-like beard and a hat like Castro wore and with the fatigues, and this guy's acting like a buffoon to get noticed.
Right.
So, then if you look at the Russia impersonation, the impersonation in Mexico City, what did it have to do with Oswald seeing, talking to Kostikov, who's the head of assassinations for the Russians for the Western Hemisphere? What's the message there? Right. It's that he and, you know, then you had other rumors that he took money from people, from Castro agents and so on and so forth. So I think an awful lot of the impersonations was to make it plausible that Oswald had a motive or you know, they saw signs ahead of time that he could have been the murderer. I'm talking about when they look back and talk to witnesses. And the second thing is they were looking for their excuse to blame Cuba, to have a reason to invade. I don't know. Maybe I'll let the others weigh in, but that's my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, one episode of impersonation is one thing. But, you know, a dozen or two dozen impersonations is certainly looking like they're trying to paint a picture about Oswald. You just don't hear about these things in such large numbers in any investigation. This is really unique, and it's unique to Lee Harvey Oswald. So in my mind, it's to paint a picture that he is something other than what he actually is.
Right. Jim, do you have thoughts on Oswald's, what his the impersonations of him might mean?
Well, wait a minute. Look, if you've got this guy going to this Lincoln Mercury dealer and speed racing a car and saying, I expect to come in from some money pretty soon. Then you have the same guy going out target shooting and hitting the other guy's target and saying words of the effect, oh, sorry, buddy, I thought I was shooting at Kennedy. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious, you know, what you're trying to do in advance of the assassination. All right. So, you know, then when you put on the whole thing about Mexico City, you know, the guy trying to defect back to the Soviet Union through Cuba, you know, then I think at the very least, it's very suggestive of what the real conspirators were up to.
One other chapter to touch on real quick, the prior plots chapter. So, you know, one of the chokeholds specifically is that, you know, there were prior plots. Paul, you had a chapter on that. You want to talk about our boy Thomas Valley?
Yeah, one thing I'll say is if I had to rename that chapter or retitle it, I'd probably call it Similar Cases, because when I first wrote the article for Kennedy's and King, I was really focused on three prior plots, one that took place in Chicago, one that took place in Tampa, and one that took place in L.A. The key thing, I'm going to pivot a little, is when you looked at these cases, you had a lot of similarity in that the patsies or the potential patsies were very similar to Oswald, and you couldn't explain that by happenstance. Namely, if you took Von Marlowe in L.A., who would have been the potential patsy, and Policarpo Lopez, who would have been the potential patsy in Tampa, you had two guys that happened, you know, to be involved with the Fair Play for Cuba committee. And another guy who thought he may have gone down in this whole thing was a guy called Richard K. Snagel, who had links with both Oswald and Von Marlowe. He pretended to, you know, rob a bank. He shot bullets in the ceiling of the bank, gets arrested. Well, what do they find in his car? He has Fair Play for Cuba committee flyers in the trunk of his car. And the more I looked into the Fair Play for Cuba committee, the more you could see that it was an absolutely dead organization. It was in a vegetative state by mid-1963. So that the odds that these you'd have these similar cases, and more of them popped up with time. And many of the cases I bring up, you had that Fair Play for Cuba committee link. But an awful lot of the potential patsies were former Marines with, you know, some of them had mental problems. The other thing that came out, and this is the case, if you take Thomas Valley, he, like Oswald, was an ex-Marine. He was stationed on a U-2 spy plane base in the Far East, like Oswald. He, you know, he was involved in training Cuban exiles, something that Oswald may have done, but at least offered to do. And the interesting thing with many of these potential patsies is they have a pawn-like movement where they're moved from a place, like take Thomas Arthur Valley. He's in Long Island in August and then is moved to Chicago in time for the motorcade to be in a tall building adjacent to the motorcade with a sort of like a Daily Plaza vista from some of the windows that would have, you know, offered the same opportunities as what we could find in Daily Plaza. The second thing you saw with Policarpo Lopez, he was in the Keys and they bring him up to Tampa. So all of these and just so you know, the Warren Commission didn't do any similar case analysis, which is, I mean, it's really standard practice to do that, is say, okay, well, were there similar cases and what can they tell us? So you can build an offender profile. So by the time, you know, you get through all these cases, what the reader should be able to take out of this is that there's a template that Kennedy was not going to be allowed to come out in 1963 alive. There was no way. There was a crescendo of activity of that nature the more November came around. And that when you look at the template, what does it mean? It means there's a guiding hand. So there's no way. I mean, you might be able to explain some of the cases, but there's no way you can explain all of them being completely separate and just happen to link to these characters, that many of whom have a link to the Fair Play for Cuba committee and so on. So I don't know if that makes sense the way I explained it, Matt.
Yeah, no, that was good. Well, hey, we got just a minute or two left here just to wrap up. I want to get everyone's thoughts real quick on Paul Landis's allegations. This is something that we included in the book just to sort of, you know, tag that we're aware that you know, they exist. But we didn't really take a firm position on the credibility of the claims. So I have a whole episode of my podcast that will have come out before this one, so everyone will be able to hear my take. So I'll keep mine to myself. But what do you all think about the Paul Landis claims? Jim, I'd like to hear yours first, if you don't mind.
I'd like to hear from the lawyers first.
Okay. Andrew, what do you got on Paul Landis?
I guess I look at it holistically. I think there's definitely some questions about all of the circumstances that he has now testified to, not under oath. I mean, the one thing that he said at the conference that really struck me is that he assisted to transfer President Kennedy from the gurney that they brought him into trauma room one onto an operating room table. And I based on other eyewitnesses that were there, that never happened. So there's a bit of a discrepancy there. I tend to believe the Parkland witnesses' testimony that took place in 63 or 64 versus Landis's memory today. But that doesn't mean he didn't find a bullet on the back of the limousine. For that, he seems quite certain that he found the bullet on top of the back seat of the limousine, and that he left it on the table where Kennedy's body was before they put Kennedy into the casket to transport him to Washington. So I don't know. There's a lot of questions that I still have. I'm not really a bandwagon kind of guy. I take under oath testimony and give it more weight than I do not under oath testimony. So I'm open to this. I find it certainly interesting because the story that we're told in the Warren Commission really doesn't add up. So this may be a more compelling explanation as to the origination of the magic bullet than what's in the Warren Commission.
Mark, do you have thoughts on Paul Landis?
No, that was well said. I mean, it's so we're 60. I mean, we're on the eve of the 60th anniversary, right? And there's so much that you could put stock in some of that. You know, I don't know. I'm not saying it lacks credibility, but you know, from a legal standpoint, I mean, how do you draw any like serious conclusions from this narrative at this point in time? I think it's fascinating. But yeah, it's tough to take it to. It's tough to make it a chokehold. Let's put it that way.
It's no chokehold. That's the indeed. Yeah. All right, Paul, and then Jim, you can go last.
Well, mine will be short. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Jim.
I'm not taking a position on Landis, one way or the other. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, well, I was going to say I did not hear him in Pittsburgh, and I did not read his book. So I don't know. I don't know. But here's what I will say that I found actually interesting is mainstream media didn't just fluff him off, you know. And I don't know that we would have seen from mainstream media what we saw with Landis today 10 years ago. So that's maybe one interesting remark, but it has nothing to do with my opinion. It's too early to form right now.
Okay, good. Those are all reasonable positions, I think. Well, hey, everybody. Appreciate having you guys on the show today. And anybody want to promote any of your individual things last minute? Jim has KennedysandKing.com. He's got a lot of books. Jim D. Eugenio, look him up. JFK Revisited, the documentary series. And yeah, anybody else have anything you want to promote?
Well, Andrew, I think you could give the name of the website, because through the website, you can follow us, the authors, on Facebook. So, sure. You know, if you have questions and if you want to see the news about our book come out as it, you know, we tend to post things like, for instance, that took place in the conferences and nice pictures and some of the press coverage we have been getting. It might be fun for some of your listeners to follow that.
All right. Sure. We have a website, jfkchokeholds.com. And like Paul says, you can see a lot of our media is updated on there, and you can certainly read about the authors, and you can link to Amazon and Barnes & Noble to order your books.
All right, sounds good. Well, hey, thanks again to Paul Blow, Jim DiEugenio, Andrew Eiler, and Mark Adamczyk. The JFK Assassination Chokeholds, available pretty much anywhere you get books. That's it for this episode of Solving JFK. We'll see you next time.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard.
Thanks for listening. Visit SolvingJFKPodcast.com for more information.